This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 71, brought to you in association with Synchron, Archover, and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined by Emmanuel Angelich, chairman and co-founder of Squirrel, whose strapline is the UK's simplest way to create and stick to a budget. They've been covered in the FT, The Times, Wired, The Daily Mail, The Sun, The London Evening Standard, CNBC, and The Sunday Times, all of which, I guess, goes to show that digital has so crucified journalism that journalists are the new poor who need such an app. Squirrel have thousands of customers, ranging from folks earning over 100 grand to those on benefits. In the latter context, which we'll focus on today, Squirrel works with local authorities and housing associations to support their residents with money management skills. Society these days is built around economics. Our current economy is entirely based on the principle of infinite greed and this structure called a corporate. Corporates are, psychologically speaking, as well laid out in Canada's finest documentary, The Corporation, psychopathic, driven by never-ending greed for more, turning people into human resources to be bought and sold, and laying waste to the environment. As we all know, increasing oligopolization is leading to more and more power in fewer of these, to use Chomsky's phrase, unaccountable totalitarian states. Between them and the permanent state, wealth is flooding up to the 0.1%, leaving near everyone behind, and some very, very far behind indeed. O tempora, o mores. What can fintech do to help? Can it help? I read an interesting blog post recently by everyone's favourite Monzo, where they'd been working with mental health professionals to see how they could help those who needed help. One phenomenon, apparently, is impulse spending. Like a dieter stuffing oneself with cakes only to be racked by guilt a day later. And in this case, tech can help by including delays or account limits or oversight or some such. This also, of course, is a massive perversity to fintechs, whose main purpose in life is to reduce friction in the customer journey. And this is an example of where maybe increasing friction in a customer journey is necessary. We'll talk about this in Squirrel's context later. Anyway, Emmanuel is deeply immersed into all this world. So rather than me waffle, let's move on to the reality. What can fintech do to help the poorer members of society? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Emmanuel, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So we were talking about which end of the cam we went to university, and then I went on the sort of south end of the cam and you went quite on the north end of the cam, but separated by a little gap insofar as you were saying that the year that I was going up to college, you were busy being born, to which, of course, I responded that this explains why I'm infinitely knowledgeable and wise. But tell me about going to college, which must have been, in your case, in the late 90s, I guess, because it's on my mind at the moment in that basically, when I was at university, it didn't really matter which university, nobody really worked very much. The FT was unseen anywhere near a sort of student bar or anything like that. And life was really a question of sort of drinking, rowing in my case, going to parties and playing croquet and punting in the summer with the occasional panic once a year when there was an exam coming up in a couple of weeks' time. Fast forwarding to today, my daughter started at UCL in the autumn doing physics, and she works amazingly hard, and they're all very sort of career orientated and career minded and all this kind of thing. And most of the purpose that I can see of going to university when I went there was to have a good time and take it easy before you spent the rest of your life having to work for a living. But now it seems even more stressful than sort of working. So in the late 90s, where was it for you on that spectrum? Were you kind of sort of the irresponsible dossy type like me who thought there were far more interesting things to do than to read your physics textbooks other than now and then? Or you're sort of near my daughter's journey where it was terribly important right at the beginning to read your physics textbook, or whichever textbooks you read.
I'm sorry if I made you feel old earlier.
I like to think of it as old and wise, you see, because I like to live in a world of delusion. It's always much better than reality.
I started in 1999, and I don't think things changed very much from when you were there. I was fortunate enough to be studying politics, which I have to say wasn't the most taxing of subjects when it came to kind of study. It wasn't certainly no maths or engineering. So the 8 hours of lectures a week, the two that I might have made here and there, were really not too difficult.
I saw something recently about PPE at Oxford being a sort of the politician's degree, but Cambridge, presumably you did SPS, Social and Political Sciences.
Yeah, I sometimes call it the poor man's PPE, just because it just doesn't feel as heavyweight. And I don't know any prime ministers who studied it, but I certainly enjoyed the course, more the drinking and the socialising side of the course, which was kind of 99% of it.
And also, you've still got a beard today, so you've clearly been influenced by the whole vibe. So how did you get then from a life which sounds like it was in the same millennium as mine, of taking it easy and drinking and socialising? I'm not quite sure. I'll have to keep asking every guest now until I pin down the year in which students started working and taking it all far too seriously.
I think it's when they started having to pay loads of money to go to university. I was fortunate enough to miss the loans and everything. It was all free for me, so it felt like it was a good use of time.
Now, that's interesting. Well, I think the other phenomenon that I see is globalisation, that Pippa's friends are all foreigners. You know, they're people who've come from a long way away, are paying a lot of money. And therefore, if you've gone halfway around the world and you've competed in the first place to get to a prestigious university in the UK, the last thing you're going to do is sort of doss around drinking. Or maybe that's just the first year, maybe in the second year, they'll all start dossing around a bit.
Very true. I mean, I sometimes wonder if I was 19, 20 again, would I spend, you know, whatever, 20,000 or 30,000, you have to kind of come away in debt to go to university. And I just kind of wonder whether that money could be invested in all sorts of other courses and travel and life experiences, which would get you the same kind of result that we used to get at university.
Yes, it's certainly a very relevant question, isn't it? And I think in terms of, you know, one of my subtexts, which is how society is increasingly sort of stuffing people de facto, making them sort of depressed, and depression is the biggest condition treated in the world, but also indebting them. You know, education, Educare, is supposed to be about leading out people's potential from them. But as we all know, whichever decade you went to university in, it's more about stuffing stuff in and seeing whether you can sort of memorise it and regurgitate it. But in the same way, your educational life now ends with making sure that you're indebted to the banks, which comes onto our theme in a minute, really. And it's sort of rather a sort of sad way that people are indebted right from the start. So how did you get from not being indebted as a student and having a good time to where we are here, which is called Runway East, Finsbury Square, which rather ironically is on the west of Finsbury Square? What happened in the meantime?
I have to say, I did walk away from university in plenty of debt. I was the guy who opened 4 bank accounts and took advantage of the interest-free overdrafts and then added a few credit cards on top. I think I was determined not to let money stop me having a good time.
So you're obviously ahead of your time, you see. So you're introducing the idea of student debt long before it really exists in the same degree.
I always figured that, you know, all those nights that people said, I can't afford to go out, I thought, we've got 3 years here, you know, well, let's just borrow and have fun. We'll earn more later. And I think going to a place like Cambridge, they bred this confidence in you that you're always going to earn loads of money later on in life. So, you know, spend now. And I have to say, I was a bit of a spend-free kind of child.
Well, also, they had this old-fashioned thing, which is a good way of indebting people anyway, which is you had, well, certainly in my college, you had an account at the bar, so you didn't actually have to pay in cash, you just signed something. So, you know, after a few beers, I would sign a piece of paper, and then it comes to the end of the term.
I think we called it the buttery card. It was a dangerous tool. I used to buy 2 meals sometimes because I couldn't choose which main course I wanted, and just because I didn't feel the pain of money leaving my hand. It's very true.
So the career journey then from indebtedness to helping people with indebtedness is roughly what?
So I left Cambridge and I was heavily indebted. I wanted to set up my own business. I had far too much debt on my hands. I was just about covering the minimum payments on my credit cards. So I took a job in recruitment, which promised me many riches and quick earning commission and gold-plated this, that and the other. It didn't particularly work out that way, but a year or so in, I ended up setting up my own recruitment agency. I could see that there was money to be made here, and it was the business I'd kind of always dreamed of setting up. And unfortunately, that business didn't go very well in the first couple of years, and I found myself borrowing money off employees. I was jumping tube barriers to get to work because I couldn't afford a travel card. So we were really struggling, and I ended up, once I couldn't borrow from employees anymore, they'd stop trusting me as their boss. I found myself going to payday lenders, and I got into all sorts of trouble. My payday lender of choice at the time was the Money Shop, and you'd go in there, write them a cheque for £100, and they'd give you £80 in cash, and 2 weeks later, cash the cheque. And I got into a terrible mess and ended up on a debt management plan through the debt charity Step Change. So long story short, the business started doing very well and I managed to clear my debt and actually successfully exited that business later on. So, you know, you can put your violins away in terms of the sob story. But the point is that I went through that pain and I said to myself at the end of that process that my next business is going to be something that kind of puts an end to payday loans or at least offers people a credible alternative to borrowing.
Well, I was about to say that's excellent, actually, but obviously it's rather painful. But as we all know, one of the things about founding businesses is it really kind of helps if you know something about the business that you're in. But you certainly seem to have taken the rocky path in terms of investigating what it feels like to be indebted and therefore having sympathy and empathy with your clients today and knowing the genuine nature of the problem. So in terms of the sort of social end of the spectrum, as we say that Squirrel covers seamlessly from people who are earning quite decent money to people who probably aren't earning anything and have to be given money to survive. How do you define the problem in the UK of just poor budgeting? Are there any sort of numbers around it or the size of the scale of it?
I think poor money management and overspending or lack of budgeting cuts across the income spectrums. People tend to get to the age of, I think it's something like eight, they learn their financial habits. They become either spenders or savers or somewhere on that spectrum. So you can be very poor on benefits and be excellent at budgeting. You have very little to handle. So it's not the amount you earn that defines it. It's your attitude to money, which I think is bred at a very early age. But we know in the UK there's a huge problem with people not saving enough. I think the average household in the UK has less than £500 of savings, and generally the recommended amount is 6 months' worth of bills, so that if you were to lose your job, that you can carry on for 6 months. So we have a big problem in the UK that people just simply don't set aside money. Exacerbating that, you have the debt culture, the consumer credit culture, and I think in the last stats in December 2016, the average household was £7,000 in debt, in terms of consumer debt. So there's a real problem.
And the average salary, I don't know, but it's something like, what, is it 20 grand or 18 grand or something like that? So people are indebted as quite a large fraction of their salary. So in terms of the budgeting, and obviously it's even more important to budget well when you've got next to no money than it is when you've got sort of 100 grand, because all you've got to do is stop buying champagne for a few weeks and, you know, your 100 grand will cover quite a lot, unless you're sort of gambling it away, which is a different phenomenon. In the past, which I was exposed to more of than you, there used to be things like gas meters where you literally put a coin in the gas meter, especially for those with less money. And when that ran out, your house was cold, but at least it meant that you couldn't be indebted to the gas company. You'd have to put on more clothes and all this kind of stuff. And one of the things we get is all this stuff around financial inclusion, and there's loads of PC bullshit around this. I mean, I feel that there's massive kind of irresponsibility in this, because the one thing that the banks do is sell you debt very well. You mentioned the payday loans. You know, they're at one end of a spectrum, the other which is a bank. I mean, I'm always getting banks saying, oh, do I want to borrow 10 grand, or here's another credit card, or funding circle. You know, people are always trying to lend you money in this kind of society. So one of the ironies of all these people who try and be sort of socially aware or whatever in fintech and all this kind of stuff, and talk about the unbanked and all that kind of stuff, is that actually there's great protection in being unbanked. Because if you've only got cash, you can't spend what you haven't got. If you've got a bank account and overdrafts and credit cards, they're absolutely going to make money out of you spending what you don't have. So we had this kind of much more cash budgeting in the past. And how has that changed?
My mother-in-law still uses a prepaid gas meter. And when I go around there on weekends, I have to put like three jumpers on, and she gives me a blanket to stay warm because she's so scared of putting more money in the meter. But more worryingly, those meters eat money like crazy. I think like an average two-bed flat costs something like £80 a week to heat through a gas pay meter. So it's a real poverty premium. But I would ask my mother-in-law, why don't you just switch to a monthly tariff? And she's petrified of the idea of a bill landing in a month's time with an unknown amount of money on there, partly not helped by the fact she can't read. But there are people in lots of different situations who need to have control, and they will pay a massive premium to have that control.
This is embarrassing for me, but I didn't realise that gas meters were still around, firstly. And secondly, I didn't realise you had to sort of pay through the nose for them.
The actual cost per kilowatt hour is hugely more as well. So it's a huge problem. It's a similar problem to people who are less financially capable not switching their energy tariffs. It's fine for people on higher incomes. They pay a premium, but they can afford so. But people who aren't very well educated or financially literate find themselves stuck on very expensive tariffs. And, you know, as much as I see the benefits of privatization, it's really hard to see how privatisation in the energy sector in this case is really serving our society.
Yes, indeed. And so is there any kind of stats, most of which I wouldn't trust anyway, but it's always good to have a stat, around the cost to society of poor money management?
Good question. There's lots of stats. I know when we first started out Squirrel, we initially went through employers. We would offer Squirrel accounts to employees, and the employers would pay for it, because there was a strong argument to say that actually the cost of financial mismanagement in the workplace is about 4% of a company's bottom line. So that's tied to greater absenteeism, greater likeliness to suffer from stress, anxiety, take time off. You're less productive when you're thinking about money issues. Half of all marriage breakdowns have their root cause as financial problems. You know, there's a huge amount that's affected by mismanagement of finances, and often you get situations where it's hard to tell whether financial problems cause mental health issues or it's the mental health issues causing financial problems. And I think the two kind of interplay and exacerbate one another.
Yes, it's a huge problem because, I mean, you mentioned the divorces, which not a bunch of laughs having a divorce anyway, but that, of course, it affects the children and the children affect the children's children and all that kind of stuff. And I was watching Yanis Varoufakis talking about guaranteed basic income. And I think in the context of Switzerland having had a vote on this kind of thing, which would certainly sweep away the vast cost and all these means-tested benefits and all this kind of stuff if everybody was giving a basic income so at least they didn't starve. And the context being, of course, that more and more automation is, and even the economists acknowledge this, for the first time, not meaning that jobs are displaced from one sector into some new sector, but that just jobs are displaced full stop.
Yep.
So that's the context. It's really important beyond economic numbers. I mean, I'm glad you didn't come up with a number saying, oh, it costs society £15.7 billion or something like that.
I'm sure someone has.
So I'm sure they have. People come up with these things, but it's complete fantasy, but it costs far more than that in terms of pain. Now, the government is supposed to be there to help people and all this kind of stuff, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. But as I understand it, recent government welfare reforms have really changed things quite a lot.
Yes, there's the introduction of what they call universal credit.
Which, especially for people outside the UK who don't know, and probably for half the audience in the UK who don't know what it is.
At the moment, there's this myriad of different benefits, from housing benefits, income support, to job seekers allowance, employment support allowance, personal independence payments. You know, a whole. You need a degree in benefits to be able to understand the system. And so the government sensibly, I think, have decided to consolidate all of those benefits into one payment, which they call universal credit. And the idea is that they're trying to incentivize work, so it should never not pay to get a job. At the moment, we've got this perverse system where you can lose benefits if you get a job and you end up having less money in total, discouraging work itself. So we do have a very messed up benefit system which needs reform. The problem with universal credit is that they are consolidating all of these often weekly or bi-weekly payments into one big monthly sum. And I think the idea is that they want to try and bring people more in line with what your average employed person does. And in the UK, most people are paid a monthly salary. The problem with this is that when they introduce universal credit, suddenly people who otherwise had their housing benefit, their rent paid for them direct to their landlord, are suddenly getting, in some cases, thousands of pounds in their pocket. And these are people who barely had more than £100 in their account at any one time. And believe it or not, lo and behold, people go and spend that money. They think this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And the Croydon Council, that's a council in South London, who have recently piloted the universal credit system, found that their rent collections from social tenants dropped by 30%. So that's, you know, a huge chunk of people going out and having a great time.
So it's a good example of where the best will in the world, once it's implemented or executed slightly poorly, ends up exacerbating the problem they're trying to move in the first place, which is this massive indebtedness. I know Croydon Council very well because the bastards cut down 400 trees in Purley recently, and the local residents association found they've got only funds to replace 100 of them. And most of the trees, I couldn't see anything wrong with them in the first place. That's a separate thing. So the problem that you're solving at the kind of local authority, local council, housing association level is getting considerably worse, in that there are considerably more people, if this keeps rolling out in the current way, who are really going to be very much in pain. I can understand the mentality myself, you know, especially if you're unemployed and your life's terrible and everything's awful and all that kind of stuff. You suddenly get loads of money, it goes on sex, drugs and rock and roll, because at least you can feel good for a week, even if actually you feel shite for the next 3 weeks.
Absolutely. And actually sometimes it's, you know, they finally buy the clothes they've always wanted. They go to Disney World. You know, there's lots of good stuff that these people do because they just think this is my one chance, and they do it. And, you know, I don't blame them per se. I think the system just needs to be designed in a slightly more considerate way, so that this doesn't happen.
Yes, so we can actually sit around and wait for the government and the governments of the world as a whole to design society in a more socially considerate way. And I think we'll all probably be dead by the time that happens, because we've got a very mad society. This is a complete tangent, actually. I was reading last year a number of books about Lakota, Native American tribe, and how their society was organised. And, you know, they had societies which were structured around real wisdom. And the idea stuck in my mind. The idea was that the chief of the society, his job was to make sure everybody's looked after. So often you had the chief of society, the chief of tribes in the Lakota, was the poorest man because he'd give away all his stuff because he was a great, wise, benign leader.
That's his job.
Exactly, it's his job. Although, of course, that the these awful white men that came and raped the country have gone the opposite way around, which is the benefit of the 0.1%. But anyway, let's move off this. So it's only getting worse, and we can either wait for the state to fix it, or we can, at the best, some of us, or not we, because I'm not doing anything, but you are, and one or two others are in fintech, actually look to see what practically fintech can do to help people outside the 0.1% or the 1% or even the 10% that fintech tends to focus on. You're talking about all this sort of savvy stuff. I was amazed recently, I won't say where, but I was talking to a group of people from the regions who were very financially savvy, and frankly, most of them hadn't heard of market invoice or all that kind of stuff. And these are people who spent decades in finance in the region. So
yeah.
It's called the London Fintech Podcast. And ironically, I was made aware that actually fintech is still, in large part, a London phenomenon that people in Dorset or Newcastle might not know much about at all, although Atom Bank's in Newcastle. Just picking that at random.
I think we often live in a bit of a fintech bubble here, assuming everyone else knows all these glamorous startups that we think are dominating the world. They're still only a tiny fraction of the overall market.
Exactly, exactly. And then, you know, the average fintech, frankly, is aimed at the top 10%, shall we say. If you're peer-to-peer or something like that, you're trying to borrow or you're trying to lend, you're probably going to be the upper echelons. So looking at those people in the bottom 50% or 10% or whatever, how can fintech help, Emmanuel?
We didn't set out to help the bottom any percent. We set out to help people who are not good at managing money, and that, like as I said earlier, cuts across the income spectrums. The way we design our solution is, when we first started, we were looking at what is it that makes people not manage their money well, what makes them not budget, and what makes them run out of money and get into debt. And we found that the single biggest cause of debt is people were telling us that if I have the money, I spend it. You know, it's the temptation to spend. If it's there, I will spend it. And, you know, you're either that way inclined or you're not. And for the roughly half of the population who are, that is the problem that needs solving.
This is true. I mean, at an anecdotal level, one of my daughters has always sort of saved her pocket money and ended up with lots in the piggy bank. The other spent it straight away. And it still happens now, oh my God, a decade after having pocket money in the first place.
Absolutely, spenders or savers. And yeah, we're catering for spenders. There are the kinds of people who keep spreadsheets and have multiple bank accounts. They're not our customers. They are people who know how to manage their money. They may or may not benefit from our tool, but they don't need the tool. We're aiming it at that other half of people. And we kind of looked at what was out there in terms of tools and fintech when we first started. And there are lots of these kind of money dashboard. In the US, there's a Mint and OnTrees over here in the UK who show you where you've spent your money after the event. So they'll give you a nice pie chart and they'll tell you how much you spent on coffee and all this good stuff. And the idea being that by seeing where your money's going, you may change your behavior. Now, we did lots of research into this area, and the people we're trying to help, their behavior does not change as a result of seeing where money went. They are very good at ignoring, living in the moment, and just kind of just spending as they wish. So the only solution for us was to kind of go back to basics, what people were doing for hundreds of years, jam jar saving, putting money in pots, thinking ahead and saying, you know, I need electricity this month, let's put it in the electricity jar. So we took some good old-fashioned principles like jam jar saving, and we remove that money from people's everyday accounts. That's how Squirrel works. We set aside money for bills, we set aside money for holidays, birthdays, Christmas, so that people can't spend it. And then on top of that, for people with a monthly income, we give them the option of paying themselves a weekly allowance. Again, a really simple concept, but if you have all your money at the beginning of the month, you're probably going to spend it at the beginning of the month. Let's spread that out. So it's like giving yourself an allowance.
And the mechanism of this is what? I mean, I'm not a particularly profligate spender. I think I'm much better at sort of eating biscuits and chocolate and things like that in terms of lacking complete self-control. If you put me in front of some Belgian chocolates every time I walk past, I can't stop myself eating one. But if I download Squirrel and use it, how does it actually mechanically work? I mean, how do you do these things and stop me spending my money? Coming back to this earlier point about the thing that I had the takeaway from Monzo on mental health was about introducing friction points, which is incredibly ironic because the vast majority of fintech is about removing friction points. How do you make it a frictional journey for me to spend my own money, as it were?
So we spent a long time trying to figure this out, and we built Squirrel on an e-money platform. So you pay your income into Squirrel. That's the first port of call for your money and your benefits, your salary, whatever income you get, put it into your Squirrel account. Squirrel then holds that money back until you need it, and it only pays money into your regular bank account when you need it.
Okay, so the vast amount of money that I make from the FinTech podcast would flood into Squirrel, multiply your wealth manyfold over, and then you would dribble it out to me.
You set your budget in the app, you set your savings goals in the app, you tell us when your bills are due, and we pay money into your account when they're due.
Going back to the changes in the universal benefit, where the government used to pay the landlord but now pays the people, some of whom spend it before it gets to the landlord, in the particular case of Squirrel, then the money will go to you, but if I've got to pay the landlord on Tuesday, you will transfer in the money on the Monday or Tuesday. You don't transfer it to the landlord and pay it directly.
With social housing, we've adapted the product to actually pay rent and council tax direct to the council. So there's a huge win-win there. The local authorities are identifying people who need help, who are often in rent arrears or are struggling financially. They are offering them incentives to use Squirrel and paying for Squirrel for them. In return, they're getting their rent paid direct. The resident doesn't fall into arrears. And in lots of cases, we're helping people in temporary accommodation, living in hostels, funded by the local authorities to move into permanent homes because they can demonstrate an ability to budget. So we kind of built Squirrel to help consumers broadly who struggle to manage money, but we soon saw that what we had built is actually almost an antidote to the benefits changes that we were
talking
about.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
We didn't design it such, but Universal Credit is paying rent directly to the users. It's paying big monthly lump sums, and we reverse that. We can pay rent direct, and we can pay weekly allowances.
In effect, I mean, probably as well like this, in effect, there's an option in the app, as it were, and you click it, and the money dribbles to me, or you click it the other way, and the money dribbles to the people I need to pay to make sure that I don't spend it on Belgian chocolates in the meantime. And you having said that you're a very good spender, Emmanuel, why should I give you, Squirrel, my money? Because you might spend it all.
You know, so Squirrel accounts are held in the user's name. They're e-money accounts with their own sort code and account number. The money's not held by Squirrel. It sits in a Barclays account in the back end, so it's protected by FCA regulations.
So you're FCA'd and your client money rules and all that kind of stuff, so the money isn't going to Squirrel. It's just going into a Barclays bank account, and Squirrel is doing the administration on the top and making these things happen. Good. Okay, so one dimension we haven't covered, Emmanuel, is we've spoken about the app and how you set up all these budgets and all that kind of stuff, and that can sound incredibly mechanical. And let's say I crash my car or some emergency happens or something like that. There is a valid reason that I need my money. I'm not just buying my Belgian chocolates. So how does it work? Because I know you've got human beings in Squirrel, and not only that, but I've seen people on your website saying they called and spoke to a human being and they were very helpful to them.
Yeah, a lot of our customers comment on the level of customer service they receive, even if it's a simple web chat they have with our advisors, or they can pick up the phone and speak to us at any time. The way the app's designed is if you have, you know, fixed commitments like rent being paid out later on in the month, or if you've set firm kind of bills that need paying, there's no withdrawal button in the app. We try not to encourage people to take out money that's destined for other things. You know, it's self-discipline, but of course it's their money. So if there is an emergency, their car breaks down, the boiler goes bust or something, they can obviously give us a call, send us an email, and they'll get a helpful, friendly response. So we've had it said a lot of the times that people feel like Squirrel is their kind of financial buddy, their coach, in lots of ways, which is a really good thing.
Okay, so the main point here is, of course, that you're not just an app. There is sort of human beings behind it. The other aspect of this is that, as you were talking about before, financially undisciplined people or people not used to budgeting are by definition not used to budgeting. It's like, I'm not used to playing the violin. And you could say, oh, here's a violin and here's an app, but it wouldn't necessarily learn the violin. How does Squirrel work with actually kind of teaching or tutorialing people along this? Do you have sort of, you know, educational videos embedded or whatever? I mean, it sounds trivial, but it's not trivial, of course.
You're right, budgets are daunting things. People kind of avoid doing them. And like all good tech products, we've designed it in such a way that it is intuitive. It's quite obvious what you do next. But where people don't do things that we think are kind of good for them financially, like, you know, set up appropriate savings goals, they'll get a nudge from Squirrel. So if it gets to June, for example, they haven't set up a Christmas savings goal, the Squirrel app will give them a nudge saying 6 months to go till Christmas, now's a good time to start saving. So we don't give advice as such, but we liken ourselves to a kind of personal trainer or a kind of coach for your finances.
Excellent. Well, that all sounds very good, actually. It sounds like the right attitude. It's probably a good time to get into Squirrel in a bit more detail. But before we dive a little bit more into Squirrel, per se, having moved on from this social housing challenge end of the spectrum of budgeting, although, as you say, budgeting, it is something which affects everybody around the world, and some people are good at it, and some of them aren't. Before we wrap up, I'd like to thank all my listeners out there, all the spenders and all the savers, and also my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, smart, simple, and transparent P2P business lending. Loans up to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. Synchron, digital, business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries and over $400 million of revenue. So diving into Squirrel a little bit, you've explained how it works, and I assume that in the typical fintech way, it's a relatively straightforward app slash product to engage with. So what's your challenge as a business? Is it just taking 7,000 customers and turning them to 70,000 and doing, you know, for taking, I don't know how many local authorities are working with, a dozen and turning it into 100? I mean, are you just in the scaling phase at this stage?
So we just completed a crowdfunding round, an investment round, so that we're well funded to drive growth.
And if you put that in the Squirrel account, so it dribbles out to you.
Everyone at Squirrel uses Squirrel accounts. It's, okay. It's one of the, it's not quite a rule, but we like to, what they call,
eat your own dog food. Yes.
So we've left a bit of investment available for strategic investors.
And how much did you raise?
Just under 600,000. So we're beefing up our advisory board. So if there are any strategically aligned people out there, we'd be willing to hear from them if they're interested in joining our journey. And yeah, so it's all about scaling and you know, getting people better with money.
Excellent. And how many staff have you got at the moment?
Got 9 people at the moment.
Okay. And so that's where you've been, that's where you are. And what's the particular journey? What's your plans for 2017, 2018? Are you still going to try and, as it were, have this business that goes across the spectrum? Or are you going to have sort of effectively two notional divisions focusing on slightly different products? One where it's via the social housing and they've got the box ticked, so it goes to the person who needs the bill. And the other for the people who've got just better cash flow but just don't want to spend too much on Belgian chocolates.
So yeah, we've got these two distinct divisions. The product's essentially the same. It helps people manage their money better, but we're driving our consumer subscriptions and we're also looking to expand the range of local authorities and housing associations we're working with. But we also see an opportunity. The system we've built is one that just works. You know, you can check out the reviews we have online independently. You know, people's lives are being changed by this product and we want to get that to as many people as possible in the future. And I think one way we can do that is we're in early discussions with credit unions, for example, about, you know, giving them this as an online offering to reach more people. And it's much more in keeping with the credit union ethos of helping people to save and budget. Unfortunately, credit unions at the moment don't have much by way of tech, so we think that there could be a really interesting alignment there. But equally, banks or building societies, those kind of organisations who really genuinely want to help their customers budget and save. The cynical side of me would say that banks probably don't have an interest in helping them because they make so much money out of getting people in debt. But I'm sure there are some organisations out there who genuinely want to help, and we've built something that genuinely works, so keen to hear from them as well.
Excellent. Well, I started off waffling about the problem of everything flooding up to the 0.1%. And ironically, of course, fintech can only exacerbate that at times, which is that, you know, 1,000 fintechs launch in London and 990 go completely bust and 10 of them do quite well and one of them does incredibly well. So actually the money ends up sort of flooding towards the successful, which is the way it is. But it is genuinely nice to hear people whose business is aimed at focusing on those less well-off who will never get the billion-dollar unicorn exit, blah-de-blah-de-blah-de, but really helping this thing called society, which is all too easy to forget in the atomized world where there's excess competition and not enough cooperation. And I think that, you know, your personal journey itself is very touching. There's a theory that we all chose the sort of big picture of our lives before we started, that, you know, the sort of the before you get to be born, you've got this sort of like on a virtual reality thing. You go, oh, I'll have that one kind of stuff, you know, that your higher self chose it. There's a book about this on Amazon, which isn't as crazy as it sounds, because there's plenty of cultures in the world that believe in rebirth, reincarnation, or whatever. Anyway, someone's comment in that was, if this is true, I'd love to meet my higher self who chose my life for me and throttle it. So at various times, it must have been true that your journey was painful. But in a way, the benefit of that is that you, having felt the pain, you're then very motivated to help people with these genuine pains out there and really help them avoid getting into the traps that you fell in and the awful state of being indebted without having any money to sort of float to your boat. So I wish you every success, Emmanuel, and Squirrel every success in the future. And as you say, maybe you're the antidote to some of these benefit changes that are happening right now in the UK. And hopefully you can be inspiration for other fintechs around the world. We're in many, many countries get listen to this show, who can do a similar thing over there. I certainly hadn't appreciated before talking to you that something as simple as, apparently simple, as an app to help you budget with your spending can actually have such leverage from a social perspective. But thank you for the lesson as well. So I wish you every luck. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.